The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, your usual podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeals. But this week, only one of the three cases is from the Federal Courts of Appeals, just because we felt like doing two other ones that were interesting. I'm your host, John Ross, joined this week by IJ attorneys Paul Sherman and Dan Albin. This week on the show, not impartial forensic scientists, felon re-enfranchisement, and the constitutionality of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's single directure. Dan, kick us off.
Sure. Well, the first case we're going to take a look at is actually out of the Court of Criminal Appeals of Tennessee. It's State of Tennessee versus Decasimo, and it's a case involving a number of folks who were convicted of DUIs challenging the fact that the forensic scientists who did the blood alcohol tests received a $250 fee for every conviction. This money goes directly to the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation and is earmarked for the forensic science unit. About $3 million a year is raised through these fees, and they're only paid if there's a conviction in the case. The folks who were convicted of these DUIs challenged this, saying, look, I have a due process right to an impartial forensic test, and the fact that these folks have a profit incentive, a $250 fee for every conviction, increases the likelihood that they're not going to be impartial when they're doing my blood test.
Yeah, and this goes to an issue that at the Institute for Justice we see in a lot of our civil forfeiture work, where police are able to go out, police for profit, retain the proceeds of their forfeitures and fund the departments. And this really goes to kind of one of the most fundamental divisions of power in state and federal governments, which is that the legislature controls the purse and then the executive executes the law. And so really it's the legislature that's supposed to be deciding how much policing is occurring. And when agencies are able to self-fund, we get more policing than the legislature has decided we should have. And that was a problem, at least for this appellate panel.
It was. The court points out multiple times that the issue is not that the fee is collected or that the fee is necessarily charged for a conviction. It's that the fee doesn't go to the general fund that's then, you know, distributed by the legislature, but that the fee goes directly to the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation. And that is what creates the profit incentive. Of course, in the civil forfeiture context that we frequently litigate here at IJ, that is a recurring problem where law enforcement agencies get to keep for themselves the proceeds of forfeitures rather than sending the money to the general fund. So that made a big difference to this court. It rejected one of the arguments made by the folks who were challenging their convictions. It said, look, yes, there is a longstanding tradition that judges must be neutral and that they can't have a bias and you can't judge in your own case. But we don't think that forensic scientists are really acting as judges here. And so the court sort of instead went under its own substantive due process theory under both the U.S. Constitution, the 14th Amendment, and the Tennessee Constitution, and said, look, notwithstanding any of these other things, people still have a right to sort of impartial examination of the evidence, impartial scientific testing, and the fact that there's this potential for bias violates that right, even if there are other safeguards.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things about this is there was really not evidence in this case of systematic problems in terms of these forensic scientists getting the results of these blood alcohol tests wrong. And in fact, there was a situation discussed in the case where one of the scientists accidentally switched two of the samples, resulting in someone them finding a blood alcohol level of something like over 0.2, when in fact his alcohol level was 0.01. But then they went back and they tested like 2,400 of this guy's other samples, and they found that they were all within a statistically negligible difference. So it's not that the scientists were doing a bad job. It's not even that they were actually biased necessarily. It was that there was this potential for bias, and the court really, really takes this seriously.
It does. And although the court doesn't cite the opinions from the U.S. Supreme Court cases like Williams v. Pennsylvania and Caperton about the appearance of bias being enough to invalidate a court proceeding, the court nonetheless sort of uses language that suggests that anything that calls into question and diminishes public confidence in the results of these cases is problematic. And the one sort of odd thing about this opinion is the court in addressing this appearance of bias problem mentions Marshall v. Jericho, a case about whether having a prosecutorial incentive for that affects the decisions in the case creates a due process violation. And the court sort of looks at Marshall v. Jericho and just quotes from part of the opinion that talks about how, well, prosecutors aren't held to the same standard as judges, but kind of misses one of the big points from Marshall v. Jericho, which is that the court says, but that doesn't mean prosecutors don't have to be held to some standards, aren't required to follow the Constitution. And in this case, in Marshall v. Jericho, when you're only getting 1% of your total budget or less from the fines that are being imposed, you don't really have a strong incentive. In the contrary to Marshall v. Jericho, though, in this case, the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation is getting $3 million a year and says they would have to lay off 9 forensic scientists if they didn't receive that funding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and that echoes, again, a lot of the stuff we see in these civil forfeiture cases where district attorney's offices say that, you know, if we couldn't have these forfeiture proceeds, we may have to lay off attorneys. So, you know, possibly creates a additional ammo for the fight to end civil forfeiture and policing for profit.
Okay, let's move on to the next case, which comes out of a federal district court in Florida. Paul.
Yeah, so this is James Michael Hand v. Rick Scott out of the Northern District of Florida. It is an exceptionally fiery case decided by Judge Mark Walker of my alma mater, the University of Florida. And it's a case about felon reenfranchisement and the level of both sort of process and First Amendment protection that people have if they're trying to get their voting rights restored. Basically, Florida has a situation where felons who have been their right to vote has been removed after 5 to 7 years can reapply to have their voting rights reinstated. But the process that they have is completely arbitrary. There are no time limits that are imposed on it, and it is left essentially to the unfettered discretion of the governor. And this has led to some troubling situations, for example, where a guy who was convicted of felony vote fraud went before this panel and he was asked about his crime and he actually confessed to the governor that, well, you know, I cast my illegal ballot for you. And the governor reinstated his right to vote, which at least creates some appearance or at least the risk that this is being used maybe for partisan motives or to reward some types of felons and not other types of felons. And this really, really, really upset Judge Mark Walker, who writes an extremely fiery opinion and decides that this violates not just the First Amendment, but also the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment.
And there's also some evidence not only that the governor is showing favoritism to people who might vote for him, but also that they're rejecting applications from folks who might vote the other way.
Yeah, the opinion points out a number of examples of cases where someone applied the reinstatement of their voting rights and didn't receive it because of, for instance, some indication that they were upset either with the process itself or had political leanings that were different than the governor and the board, whereas similarly situated people who did express conservative views or did express some sort of support, generally speaking, for the process or the governor did receive their voting rights being restored. The case also talks about one example where 4 out of 5 folks who did not have their voting rights restored were racial minorities, and the one person who did was white, and suggests that there may be some bias going on in how these determinations are being made.
So then the question is, does this violate the First Amendment? This turns out to actually be kind of a deep and unsettled question, because it's a collision between, number one, an unsettled question of First Amendment law, which is whether votes are themselves expressive acts that are protected by the First Amendment. And then two, whether the limitations of the First Amendment apply to acts of executive clemency, because traditionally, clemency powers or pardon powers are seen as essentially unlimited. There's some suggestions by individual members of the Supreme Court that there may be some limits on them. But for the most part, it's seen as a free-for-all. So what the court does first is look at just whether the act of voting is expressive, and it decides that it is actually protected by two components of the First Amendment, the right to associate and also the right to speak. I find this to be kind of an interesting outcome because, on the one hand, the function of voting in the aggregate isn't really to express; it's to elect our leaders. But there's actually very strong social science evidence that, on an individual basis, the reason people vote is largely expressive. Their individual vote doesn't sway the outcome of the election, and they go to the polls, they cast their ballot because they do want to express their affiliation with a politician or with a political party. So I think there's actually a reasonably strong argument that the First Amendment is implicated by the right to vote, and Judge Walker clearly thought so.
Yeah, I mean, he looked, I think, not just at the act of voting itself, but the various things that sort of accompany voting, such as being a member in a political party, being politically active, a variety of other things that have to do with First Amendment associational and speech rights, and express concerns that those rights were being trampled by this arbitrary process. The opinion really emphasizes the length to which the rules for the governor and the board are completely open-ended, and even describe themselves as giving unfettered authority to the governor multiple times. And in addressing the equal protection claim in the case, points out that, you know, even in situations where a governor may have, you know, at least theoretically unlimited authority, that still has to be exercised consistent with equal protection, with equal protection principles. And so the court expresses concerns that, look, you can have, you can say that, you know, there are various rules and safeguards, but ultimately, you know, even when you're making these decisions with very little guidance, it still has to be consistent with constitutional principles. And I think that's a holding that maybe has a broader impact from this case, because there's lots of areas where administrative agencies or other bodies may be making decisions with very little guidance and maybe pretty arbitrary decisions. And a lot of times courts will try to say, well, you know, the fact that you have a right to appeal this to a court, or, you know, that you have, you know, some other avenue for pursuing this, means sort of no harm, no foul. And I think this opinion calls that into question, and may have impacts well outside of the issue of re-enfranchising voters.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, so, you know, typically it is easier to win First Amendment claims than it is to win equal protection claims, at least equal protection claims like this, where there isn't, you know, evidence of or there isn't strong evidence of racial bias, or where racial bias isn't sort of written into the law. So that could end up being the broader holding. I think another interesting question raised by this case, although it's one that Judge Walker sort of tries to disclaim, is what this is going to mean for felons who are trying to get their right to keep and bear arms restored. He says in a footnote early in the opinion, essentially, that, you know, like the considerations that govern First Amendment rights are totally inapplicable to the restoration of the right to keep and bear arms. But, you know, the Second Amendment is a part of the Constitution, and it seems like if you can't have an arbitrary process for restoring First Amendment rights, you certainly can't have an arbitrary process for restoring Second Amendment rights. So I suspect we will see further litigation about that.
And one area where I think it has some implications for some of our work here at IJ is in the area of administrative forfeitures. Something like 88% of all federal forfeitures are actually handled administratively by administrative agencies. And the determinations made by those agencies about whether the forfeiture is completed or how much money might be returned to the property owner is considered an act of grace, basically, by the agency, and is held to no real standard. And it's been defended as something that is okay because if someone wants to, they can file a claim asking that their case be handled by a court rather than the agency. But in most of these cases, you don't get to challenge the administrative agency's decision if you decide to go that route. And we have no idea why these agencies are making the decisions that they're making. There could be all sorts of bias going on, and there would really be no way to know, and really no check on that. So I think it calls into question some of these processes that have been going on for decades, but have been thus far sort of immune to judicial review.
Yeah, the real question now, I think, is going to be what happens with this case on appeal, because I think the state is definitely going to take this case up to the 11th Circuit. And these are unsettled questions of law, so there's really no predicting how the 11th Circuit is going to decide it. But when they do, you'll likely hear about it here.
Okay, let's move on to our final case, which comes out of the D.C. Circuit. Dan?
Sure. So this is the PHH v. CFPB case. And I think we've already covered this on this podcast before when the original panel decision came down back in October. This is the en banc decision, which is there's 250 pages of opinions, but
it's
in
a
nutshell, say what?
It's a beast of an opinion.
It is a beast of an opinion. In a nutshell, it's about whether the unique structure of the CFPB, where there's a single director who cannot be fired for cause by the president, and which has an independent source of funding outside of congressional spending authorizations, whether that violates the separation of powers, and whether it creates an agency that just sits too far outside what the president can do. And this case is part of a longer conversation in the judiciary and at the Supreme Court about what the limits are on independent agencies and on the president's power to dismiss the heads of agencies. And there's sort of been an ebb and flow on this over the years.
Yeah. And so the real question here fundamentally is, how do we interpret Article 2 of the Constitution, which vests the executive power of the federal government in the president of the United States? And there are some people who have taken what's called sort of a unitary executive view, which means that those words are taken literally. All of the executive power is vested in the president for him to delegate and control as he sees fit. And other people think that the legislature has substantially more control over how the president can use that power.
And so the Supreme Court has addressed this several different times. And we're just going to give you the quick hits version of some of these cases in order to better understand what's going on in this CFPB case. The first major case in this area was Myers back in 1926, which questioned whether or not the president had the authority to dismiss a postmaster and determined that, in fact, yes, part of the president's authority under Article 2 is to dismiss the heads of executive agencies. And that's kind of one of the cases that the folks challenging the CFPB tried to marshal in their favor.
Right. But jump forward to 1935, the New Deal, you have this case called Humphrey's Executor, which dealt with a gentleman named Humphreys, who was a commissioner on the Federal Trade Commission, who President Roosevelt wanted to fire because he didn't view him as being sufficiently on board with the New Deal. So he sent him a letter saying, you're fired, and Humphreys just kept showing up to work. And so this led to a Supreme Court case about, you know, can the president fire this guy when the legislature has said that he can only be removed for inefficiency or malfeasance or essentially for cause? And the Supreme Court says, no, when they're acting in this kind of quasi-judicial capacity, you don't have the power to just fire them for any reason. You can only fire them for cause. So then jump forward a few decades, you get this case, Morrison versus Olson, which is about the federal independent counsel statute, which was used kind of most famously and notoriously in the Whitewater investigation. And the question is the independent counsel legal? And the Supreme Court holds that it is, that you can have this independent investigator who the president has no control over and can't fire, which drew at the time a very sharp dissent from Antonin Scalia, who said that, look, this strikes at the very heart of the separation of powers. If this guy is within the executive branch, the executive has to have the power to remove him.
And so those two cases kind of form the outer limits thus far of what the courts have upheld in terms of independent agencies being sort of beyond the president's authority. But the pendulum swung back a little bit, possibly due to the influence of Justice Scalia's dissent in Morrison v. Olson in 2010 in the Free Enterprise Fund v. Public Company County Accounting Oversight Board. And that's a case where the members of this board could only be dismissed by the commissioners of the SEC. And so there was this sort of – and they couldn't be dismissed for cause. And so there was this sort of double protection where the president couldn't dismiss the commissioners of the SEC except for a handful of reasons. And the SEC commissioners couldn't dismiss the members of the board except for a handful of reasons. And the court said that was too far. It insulated the members of this board too much from the executive authority and violated Article 2, violated the separation of powers, which brings us to this dispute over the CFPB. The CFPB is an independent agency. And so it argues, hey, we're just like the FTC. This is just like Humphrey's executor. You know, the independent agency there was upheld. That's okay. And there's really nothing all that unique about us. Yeah, we have, you know, one director who acts rather than a board of commissioners. But there are a handful of other agencies out there over the years that have had one director. And, you know, there's really nothing all that unique about our structure and makeup that makes us unconstitutional. And the en banc opinion sort of buys that and says, yeah, there's nothing terribly novel here. There is this somewhat unique thing about just having a director over an independent agency and not a group of people deciding. But there's nothing in the Constitution that says you have to have a board of people heading an independent agency. Of course, there's nothing in the Constitution about independent agencies, so that is true. There is no limit there. And they say, well, and you know, the fact that you can receive funding outside of congressional appropriations, well, you know, there are some other instances in which that's occurred, and you know, you add these two things together, and it really doesn't amount to much.
Yeah, and so. We'll spare you having to read all 250 pages of the opinion, but the big takeaway is that you've got a majority of the en banc panel who just takes a very broad view of precedent like Humphrey's executor and Morrison versus Olson. And then you've got a dissent that takes – well, I think that actively thinks that those decisions are wrongly decided and would like to see them overruled, but at the very least – until they are overruled, takes a very narrow view of them and doesn't want to see them expanded and wants to try and limit those cases to their facts. So this case, I think, is on a rocket ship to the U.S. Supreme Court. Like it's the kind of issue that the members of the court have expressed interest in, and I think we're going to see this case go up. And it could really shake things up. It has the potential to severely undermine, maybe even overrule cases like Humphrey's executor.
I think that's right. I think there is some question about the vehicle for which the case could get to the U.S. Supreme Court, because technically PHH actually won on the substantive matters, not the procedural matters. And there's a question about whether a cert petition could actually go up under these circumstances. But this is such an important issue and one that really goes to the heart of really the administrative state and executive authority, that if ever the court were to sort of make an exception for, you know, the requirements for a cert petition, this seems like the kind of case the court may very well want to hear, even though it might not fit the normal mold for cases that it grants a cert petition to. I think it also showcases how much the D.C. Circuit has changed in the past 5 years. I don't think you would have seen an opinion like this 5 years ago from the D.C. Circuit. But this is extremely deferential to the administrative state, really embraces Humphrey's executor and wants to actually stretch it a little bit further. And the dissent by Kavanaugh and also the dissent by Judge Henderson are really upset about that and believe this is not just a threat to this sort of abstract principle of separation of powers, but a threat to individual liberty. Because as they point out, the reason we separate the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary into separate branches is to protect liberty. And when you take an administrative agency, make it independent, give it some mix of all three of these powers, and put it beyond really any checks from both the president and Congress, you kind of create a monster that really can threaten individual liberty.
Okay, that concludes the show. Thank you for listening, and be sure to tune in next time for more judicial engagement. Until then, this is John Ross from the Institute for Justice, buoying you to get engaged.